This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
I have sitting before me somebody who I think is one of the most delightful young ladies. Her name is Claire Winton-Byrne. You may remember her from Series 2 of MasterChef this year. She was that the very clever girl who should have been there right to the end, in my very humble opinion. She joins me in the studio. Claire, welcome to Cravings.
Oh, thank you, Pete. What a lovely welcome.
Oh, it's all the truth.
Oh,
it's taken me a while to get there. And so I'm going to do some foodie news, and then we'll come back and have a bit of a chat about lots of things.
Splendid. Let's do it.
Now, jump in with any of this news if you think it's interesting or you know more than I do, because you know you do have your finger in the pies around town. Some say brave, others say stupid. Australia is set to host two further American franchised food businesses, with both Tasty Delight and Slush Puppy announcing plans to expand across the country. Freezer Australia has signed an international master franchise agreement to expand US-based Tasty Delight, a frozen yogurt retailer, into Australia, with plans to open its first location here in Melbourne in 2011. The company says it plans to open an additional 30 stores throughout Australia over the next 5 years, and it's interesting news coming on the back of US donut chain Krispy Kreme's news, which entered the Australian market to much fanfare in 2003, recently announcing the closure of 21 Australian stores due to poor sales. Rumour has it, and it's only rumour, that ice cream chain Ben & Jerry's is also in trouble. So I think that's probably more stupid than brave on behalf of Freezer Australia. Prance Hotel Max in Inner Melbourne has ceased trading at the last weekend, with the 11th hour lease negotiations falling over. For husband and wife restaurant operators Rob and Bronwyn Kabood, it means unemployment. Maybe this is the push we needed to do something for itself, says Bronwyn. Husband Rob is the talented chef in the duo. It seems that Northern Exposure will happen for St Kilda restaurant The Stoke House, which will be opening next year at the South Bank complex in Brisbane as a standalone site in a new structure on the river. Frank Van Handel, whose other Melbourne restaurants include Com, Cutler & Co and Mr Tog, believes the fit-out will begin just in January. Martha Stewart's had us all giggling this week, telling us how to get our plump Christmas turkey from the backyard to dinner table in one foul swoop. You buy it a drink. Works for most. Cookbook author and domestic mogul Martha Stewart has revealed the secret to slaughtering her own game. She gets the animals drunk first. On a guest appearance on US talk show The Colbert Report several nights ago, Stewart said she gave live birds miniature bottles of alcohol before killing them with her bare hands, and they said she would never make it in jail. Yeah. And it seems all is not well in the world of Ramsay. No, not Ramsay Street Neighbours, but Ramsay the Gordon variety. The potty-mouthed Brit has fired his father-in-law. The star chef has written an emotional open letter to his mother-in-law to defend the sacking of her husband. And Ramsay has asked his wife, Tana's mother, Greta Hutchison, not to sever ties with his family and declares the removal from his business of her husband, Chris Hutchison, to be the end of a decade of his controlling and manipulation. Ramsay removed Hutchison from the business last month after a 12-year partnership. I think that's going to get very, very ugly. One of Australia's favourite instant noodle products, Mee Goreng, is currently under investigation by food authorities in Australia and Singapore after being pulled from shelves in Taiwan. Produced by the world's largest noodle manufacturer Indomie, the Indonesian product is found in supermarkets around Australia, including Coles, Woolies and IGA, as well as specialty Asian grocery stores. In early October, Taiwanese health authorities recalled the product after finding banned amounts of the chemicals methyl P hydroxybenzoate and benzoic acid, both of which are used in cosmetics and as food preservatives. Yuck. Singaporean authorities have announced investigations into the product but have chosen not to recall it. Some of us are rethinking our alliances to the Melbourne food scene because, after a visit to Australia last year, man of the moment David Chang looks to expand his empire down under. Chang of Momofuku in New York is opening a restaurant in Sydney. It's a coup for the operators of Star City. The 33-year-old will open the revamped casino in September next year. When Chang opened his noodle bar in a tiny space 6 years ago, the music was at full volume because no one came. It didn't take long for simple dishes, including pork buns and ramen, to attract a huge crowd and have commentators saying he had reinvented the casual restaurant scene in New York. Today, the American-born son of South Korean migrants owned four restaurants, including one with two Michelin stars, and is constantly pushing culinary boundaries. He's on Time magazine's 2010 list of the 100 most influential people. He was tipped to open his first venue outside New York in Los Angeles, but he says, "I have just fallen in love with Australia. I'm fascinated by the food scene in Sydney and Melbourne. People are excited about food in Australia. It's fresh. It's energetic. New York will always be home, but there's something in Australia that Americans have never opened up at. Australians are very serious about their food, their coffee culture, and their drinks. It's a fascinating place. Thank you, Mr. Chang." I actually met him when he was out here.
Yes, did I.
A very lovely, lovely bloke.
He is. He's very interesting.
And finally, in something odd, because you know I like an odd spot, a luxury $1 million advent calendar has been unveiled at Britain's upscale department store, Harrods. Instead of the usual chocolate treats, the calendar's lucky recipient will count down the days to Christmas with gifts including a designer kitchen, a speedboat, and a pair of sunglasses made of gold. The calendar, created by Porsche Design, is one of only five available worldwide, one for each continent. And that is indeed Foodie News. We'll have a formal introduction. Welcome to Cravings.
Thank you, Pete.
So, what's news in your world? What's happened since you left that house and that competition?
Well, life's kind of returned to normal, but a very different kind of normal from what it was before. Busy writing, so I've got a column once a week, which keeps me on my toes, and I'm loving.
And if people turn to page 3 of the A2...
I think it's page 6.
Oh, page 6, beg your pardon.
Or maybe it's page 7.
Very early in the A2...
In the 48 hours section.
Today's paper, you'll see Claire's column. Today's about Spain.
It is. It's about Spain and some of the challenges of eating out when you're overseas and you don't know the place quite as well.
Because you love to travel, don't you? You're a big travel fan.
I love to travel. I think it keeps things real, you know. It reminds you about all of the good things that you have at home and opens your mind to all of the exciting things that are happening overseas.
Where's your favourite place in the world?
Spain's definitely up there. I've always loved London and I love Vietnam. Vietnam has a very special place in my heart.
Oh, really?
My dad lived there for a long time and I used to go and visit him and, you know, in terms of food alone, I'd never really eaten a whole lot of Asian food, and I guess I was about 15 at the time, and it absolutely blew my mind. You know, just amazing fare on the street for a pittance. Fascinating people, just great culture. Yeah, love it.
I have a similar relationship with Thailand, I think. I've been a number of times, and, you know, just buying hawker food on the street, walking through markets in the central Bangkok with a plastic bag full of Tom Mon Pla, the fish cakes, and sliced cucumber and sweet chilli sauce that you've paid about 20 baht for.
Yeah, I think it goes to show that sometimes, you know, it's not about the flashiest restaurants. You know, sometimes it's the simple things.
Well, look at David Chang that we were just talking
exactly.
about. A man who started serving pork buns and ramen and is now, I won't call him the enfant terrible because that's just ridiculous, but, you know, the much-adored child of the international food industry.
Yeah, I think his guiding principle is something which really speaks to me in terms of his food. His motto is just cook delicious food no matter what. And I think that, you know, that's something that I think about every time I go into the kitchen is, you know, no matter what else is going on around, just cook delicious food. Nothing else matters.
Exactly.
And I think for someone, you know, he's so successful, just to sort of have that very grounded approach, you know, I think that's quite inspiring, actually.
Do you think that's indulgent of us, though, when there's so much going on in the world that we could be giving a toss about? All we're worried about is cooking delicious food because we think that's all that matters?
No, I don't think so. And I think one of the wonderful things about food is that it brings people together. You know, everyone needs to eat. I mean, I suppose it might be a bit decadent at one level, but if you're bringing people together, then that in itself is changing the world in a way. So I don't think it's too bad a thing.
I wanted to sort of dig deep and delve into the life of somebody that's gone from a very corporate role in the world of the law to taking a risk to put an entry in for MasterChef and to finding yourself initially in a top 50 and then a top 12 and then, you know, top 6, top 5. What sort of crazy, ridiculous idea was that in the first place to say, screw the law, I want to do something with food?
Yes, I think I may have been suffering from temporary insanity at the time, and I think that's probably what most of my friends and family thought as well. It was a massive risk. You know, I could have kept going to work and, you know, I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it. And I just sort of, you know, I turned 30 and I started thinking, well, you know, who gets to their deathbed and you know, says, well, I wish I'd spent more time at work.
I wish I had.
I mean, no one says that. So I think for me it was just that kind of realisation that I wanted to be more than a lawyer, and where I was working that just wasn't possible. And I sort of had this moment of truth at about 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning after I'd watched the first episode of MasterChef I'd ever seen. And my sister said to me, you should do something like that because, you know, it would be amazing. And I said, oh, it's too hard. There's no way I could ever do that. And then I got to 2 a.m. and I was reading through someone else's amendments to a very long contract, and I just sort of thought, hang on, really? Why can't I? So I went from why or no to why not? And that was, I think, the biggest leap. And after that, it was all just, you know, when applications opened, you know, I think mine must have been one of the first ones in. and, you know, I didn't have any anticipation of it ever coming to anything, but I just wanted to have a go and take a risk. And I'm not a massive risk taker, so this is all very uncharacteristic.
You don't strike me as the spontaneous mad type.
No.
So for those that don't know, how does the process work? You send in an application, they contact you.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And then we went through an audition process, which was, I think, 2 or 3 auditions, which was culminating in the opportunity to cook for real in front of Gary and George, which is the scariest thing I think I've ever done, or it was at that point.
Which one of the two is more scary?
I think at that point they were both equally scary.
Right.
I think it was just one of those things, you know, I'm taller than both of them, but I felt, you know, about 2 inches high at that point. Yeah. But, you know, I got through and then it went through to top 50.
Yep.
And I was actually the first one through to the top 24. And then, yeah, the rest is history.
If you were to look back and ask yourself the question, should I have done that?
Are you putting me on the spot here, Pete?
what do you think your answer would be to yourself?
Yeah,
if you could give yourself the advice of 12 months ago.
Oh, look, I mean, if I knew now, you know, if I had the chance to do it again, absolutely, like no questions asked. There's no way I would be able to be where I am doing what I'm doing, which I love, if I hadn't done it. But it was incredibly hard and in ways that I think a lot of people will never understand. Very challenging for me personally, very challenging for the people that I love and I care about. I think it did quite a lot of damage. You know, there's a lot of collateral damage, which I just didn't expect. But, you know, I think I went into it sort of full of hope and very naive and a little bit Pollyanna-ish. But, you know, you live and learn.
There's nothing wrong with being a little bit Pollyanna. That person being Pollyanna is Claire Winton-Byrne. She is my first guest and my co-host, if you will, for the day. Claire, a text message for you. Were you at the AFL Grand Final?
No.
No, there you go.
I was in Spain. Which AFL Grand Final? Well, there
were several. In the Harrison room, because someone was a bartender there and I was sure he served you a vodka lime and soda.
Oh, no, well, it definitely wasn't me. I don't drink vodka.
She doesn't drink the hard stuff, Andy. Sorry we couldn't help you there. And Tristan has sent a message asking to say he's home having a glass of home brew. Thanks, Tristan. Have you watched any of the kiddies, MasterChef?
No, I haven't. To be completely honest, I'm not a massive watcher of television, believe it or not. So, no, I haven't yet. But I understand that they're just amazing.
Ah, extraordinary, phenomenal, talented children.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. Some of the stuff they put up. There's this gorgeous little 9-year-old girl called Sienna. She's down to the final 4 now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another fellow in there who is about the size of Matt Preston. He's 12. Enormous child compared to the little tiny petite blonde girl. And they're just incredible yeah. food that they... I wouldn't know if there's somebody behind them providing them with ideas or... Because what 9-year-old girl knows what Clafoutis is?
Oh, well, a precocious one, I guess, would be the answer.
Possibly.
But look, I mean, I think there's a lot of zeitgeist around food at the moment, and the kids love MasterChef. I know I went to the races last week with Callum and we were mobbed. Absolutely mobbed by the little ones at Steaks Day.
Oh, because it's family day.
That's
yes.
right. Yep. And I think that's perhaps the most exciting thing about the MasterChef phenomenon for me is that it's really re-energised an interest in food at the most important level, which is kids, you know, thinking about, you know, what they're eating, opening their eyes to all sorts of things that they might not otherwise eat left to their own devices.
And tasting new foods.
Exactly. And that's so hard with kids. So I think, you know, if we can steer them away from, you know, cakes that you buy out and maybe make them at home yourself, then that's a step in the right direction.
And get them away from ghastly places like McDonald's and...
Oh, look, I think, you know, at the end of the day, you have to pick your battles. But,
yes.
Yeah, it's... I mean, I certainly, as a kid, I think I was 5 before I had McDonald's. And the first time I went, I got food poisoning and I didn't go back for 5 years.
I think I was about 16 when I first had McDonald's.
Really?
Yes, I grew up in the bush. We didn't have such things.
Yeah, I don't think you were missing out.
No, I don't think I was either.
No.
Because I'm not... The only time I eat those is when I'm a bit mildly over-refreshed.
Yes, yes. I think that's true of
a number of
people
most.
I know. Yes.
So clearly it's all over and you're getting on with life and you're back in Melbourne, which you love.
Thank goodness. Yes. My stint in Sydney, I mean, I love David Chang and I would love to go and eat in his restaurant, but I could never, ever live in
Sydney.
But
that's an excuse to go to Sydney for a weekend.
It is.
Or during the week and eat.
That's right. Yeah. And my sister actually lives in Sydney, so...
Nice.
It's good to have an excuse to get up there.
Very good.
But yes, so yeah, back in Melbourne, life is returning to normal gradually. And it's a big change, you know, but I'm loving it. And I love the fact that I can sit at home and work on my computer with my puppy dog by my side and cook in the kitchen. And
it's good, isn't it?
I feel like a new person.
So when are we going to see Chez Claire opened on the streets or are we not? Obviously, it takes a lot of money to open a restaurant.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think... It's a bit like putting a bet on the Melbourne Cup, you know. You really have to know the form. You have to be confident in the whole team and it requires a lot of planning. So, you know, if you're going to sink $1 million, you know, in a restaurant or on a bet, you know, it's a gamble.
Here's a hint.
Essentially.
Make sure it's not your $1 million you're sinking.
Yes. Well, if anyone wants to give me $1 million to open a restaurant, please let us know.
There's an offer, people, you can't resist. Dig into your purses, find $1 million, give it to Claire, she'll open a restaurant and make you a lot more. That voice you can hear is that of Claire Winton-Byrne. I'm introducing her to you because we're about to meet our first guest on the phone. Her name is Karina Damberg. She is a maker of fabulous Australian sparkling, so much so that the Clover Hill Blanc de Blanc 2006, Clover Hill is where she works, in the Pipers River in northeastern Tasmania, has just been announced the champion wine of show at the Australian Sparkling Wine Competition. And back in September was best sparkling of show at the Australian Cool Climate Wine Show. Clearly they're doing something right there in northeast Tassie. Karina, good afternoon.
Hi, how's it going, Pete?
Good, thank you. Claire's here as well. Say hello.
Hi, Claire. How are you?
Just before you do, somebody is ringing. We've been talking about David Chang, Momofuku in New York. David Chang's 12-seat signature restaurant in New York City called Momofuku Co. is amazing. Only seats 12 people a night. It does make one wonder how one can make money out of 12 people a night. We've got some more questions for you, Claire, but we'll come back to those after we've spoken to Karina, because I believe, even though you're from Northeast Tassie, you're in Victoria at the minute, aren't you?
I am. I'm in the Yarra Valley at Domaine Chandon at the moment.
Doing a masterclass?
I am, yes, just trying a few other sparklings and some champagnes.
Very good. Now, tell us a bit about Clover Hill, first of all, because that's the employer of choice for you.
So Clover Hill was established by a French-American man called John Glett, and he's chosen this site in the Pipers River specifically to make sparkling wine. So we were one of the first vineyards in Australia planted solely for making sparkling wine. Pretty unique site as well, perfect climate for it, completely unirrigated. And originally, our very first sparklings that we released back in 91 were Blanc de Blanc, so straight Chardonnays, but now the main wine that we make, the Clover Hill Brut, is a blend of Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Meunier, so the classic champagne varieties.
What is it about northeastern Tasmania that you can produce such quality champagnes, or sparklings, I shouldn't call them champagnes, it's naughty.
Yeah, I think it's really, it's just the climate. So very, very similar to champagne in that it's marginal in terms of being quite cool. The benefit we have in Tasmania as well in the north there is being quite close to the ocean. So Clover, for example, is only 14 km from Bass Strait. You can see it from the top of the vineyard. Means that we're in a very low frost risk site as well. So you get a long, slow ripening period to get lots of fruit flavour and good natural acidity as well.
Is it cold?
It is cold. It can be.
No good for me. I don't care for the cold. You'd be feeling right at home in this Melbourne weather today, I'm sure.
Well, it's actually, I think it's actually colder in Victoria today than it was when I left Tasmania.
So how does a lovely young lady like yourself end up in this soulless business of making sparkling wine? What was that thing? What was that moment? Claire's been talking about her application to MasterChef, and she was doing something at some ridiculous hour on a Monday morning or a Sunday morning and just decided, you know what, there's got to be something that I could enjoy more. What was it for you?
Well, for me, it's always been quite ironic because my Year 12 counsellor actually said I should be a winemaker, and I went, I don't want to be a winemaker, don't be ridiculous.
Are you the only person in Australia that's...
chemical engineering degree.
Are you the only person in Australia that's actually done what their school counsellor told them?
I have, yes. Every now and again I bump into her and she just shakes her head at me and says I should have just listened to her in the first place.
So you went and studied chemical engineering. Did that give you an understanding of the applications of yeast and grapes and malolactics and business?
Not in that detailed sense, but the thing about chemical engineering is it's all about process engineering. So it's about taking a raw product and applying a process to value add or improve that product. So that pretty much covers winemaking to me. So. Mm. Yeah, but then I guess sparkling specifically, I guess because of that sort of technical science background, I like doing a lot of fiddling around. So all the extra processes that happen to a sparkling wine as opposed to just making table wine are quite interesting for me.
What is it about sparkling wine that lifts your skirt? What is it that what's the best thing about making sparkling wine?
I guess the best thing about making sparkling wine is all the lovely occasions you get to drink quality sparkling wine. So this year I've had four friends and family get married, and it's pretty cool to stand there and toast people at their wedding with a wine that you've made yourself.
Yeah, Claire, we're having this discussion about food and the joy of cooking, and I said, look, you know, there's a lot more going on in the world, and it's indulgent of us to say that as long as we go and cook something, the world will be okay. And I guess it's the same with wine. I mean, is it, I don't know. I still wonder, are we being indulgent? Are we being tosspots? Or are you in fact correct that like Claire said, it brings people together, and that in itself is a wonderful ability. It's a wonderful thing to do, whether it's over food or over a sparkling wine.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that completely. It's something occasionally I ask myself, especially, you know, when you're a bit stressed, you think, well, why am I this worked up? I only make wine for a living, you know, I'm not doing something important. But then we all need reasons
oh, yes,
to
you
celebrate
are.
And things to get together over.
It's very important, the work you do, let me tell you. Claire, is there something you wanted to ask, or are you
No, I'm good.
Happy to listen?
Good, yeah.
We've had a tweet all the way from South Australia. Good afternoon to Amanda and Glenn, who are listening in Adelaide. I think they're very big fans of this radio program. I was with them in Mildura last weekend, where I presented part of the program from the Australian Alternative Varieties Wine Show.
Oh, yeah, that's a fabulous wine show, isn't it?
Oh, my word, it is a fabulous wine show. But by about Tuesday, I think my liver was ready to file for divorce. that's my hometown, so I was able to catch up with a couple of folk that I've known for 36 and 37 years while I was up there last weekend, and I think that may have been more my undoing than the wine show itself. Interestingly, you were talking about northeast of Tassie not being non-irrigated. At the AAVWS, all of the trophies pretty much went to inland irrigated wine regions, so the Riverland, in and around the Murray. I don't even know how I'm going to phrase this question. How important is non-irrigated growth in northeast Tassie as compared to, say, what's happening in the Riverland where they rely so heavily on irrigation?
I think in Australia at the moment, it just comes down to the availability of water. So, you know, more and more you're starting to see people talking about climate change and talking about water and choosing different regions, and for that Tassie's come to the fore. But I think there's more than one way to do it. So maybe you're going to move to somewhere like Tasmania for doing things like sparkling grapes or Pinot or aromatic white wines. But then I think, like you would have seen in the results at the Alternative Varieties Wine Show last week, the way the warmer regions are addressing it is by maybe choosing their varieties a bit more carefully and making wines out of varieties that suit their climate.
Absolutely, and there's been several champions of that. With now the winning wine, which is I think there was only about 3 gold medals awarded out of 600 wines shown, so that was a little bit of a surprise. But yes, we saw the winning wine was a very little-known variety from the Riverland in South Australia, made by a young woman and selling at about $15 a bottle. So that won best wine in show, best white, and I think it won best Italian varietal as well. So they sort of sweep the pool. This lovely young lady making the wine, it's a fantastic story.
Yeah, so personally I'm always happy to see that too, because I did grow up on a vineyard in the Riverland, so it's close to home for me, that sort of thing as well.
Mm. So just before I let you go, you've made wine pretty much all over Australia, as well as making champagne in France.
Yes, and I have done a vintage in Italy as well.
So. Was that making a Prosecco?
No, it wasn't. I worked in a region called Le Marche. So mm-hmm. the white wine we were doing there is Verdicchio. Mm-hmm. And the red wine is a wine called Rossoconero, which is a blend of Montepulciano and Sangiovese.
Oh, yeah, I'd like that because I like the Montepulciano. And
yes,
I love a good, love a good
very
Sang.
Nice wine.
Karina, thank you very much. I'm going to let you get back to your masterclass.
Okay, thanks,
thank you for
please.
Joining me, and congratulations on the awards for you down there at Clover Hill.
Thank you very much.
Terrific. Good on you.
Bye.
That's Karina Danbergs, a very exciting young winemaker from the northeast of Tassie. She's a nice girl.
She's lovely.
She seems lovely, doesn't she?
Mm.
Oh, that's a bit of salt and pepper. Claire, question for you from Paul. What's your favourite occasion restaurant in Melbourne, and what's your favourite casual restaurant?
For a special occasion, I had the most magnificent lunch at Cutler & Co. a couple of weeks ago. I couldn't
I
go past it.
I love Andrew.
I just... And the service was immaculate. It was just so good. So I couldn't go past that at the moment.
Yeah, it's up in my top two. I have one that's my
well,
occasion restaurant.
I haven't been to Attica yet.
Ah, so you even you were,
yeah,
I was going to say.
I'm all over it, yeah. For the casual eat, I like Lau's Family Kitchen in St Kilda.
Nice.
And Il Funaio, if I can't get in.
Mm, go and see Philippa Sibley,
yes.
Former guest of this program. Fabulous woman. And another question. Any recommendations, Melbourne, CBD or inner suburbs, Sunday breakfast, brunch? That's from Cassie. Now, Cassie, jump over the Westgate Bridge, turn left onto Williamstown Road and head to Spotswood. There is a place called the Duchess of Spotswood. It is fabulous.
And I've heard that from someone else, so I think that's probably... A good one. Mm. I like Duke's in Chapel Street in Windsor.
See, you're on the other side of town.
I'm
a Yarraville
yeah.
boy, so I'm spruiking the west.
But we could split the difference and go with Pope Joan in Brunswick East.
I think. We could. Yeah. There's another place I found called the Green Refectory on Sydney Road. It's always busy. The staff are like too cool for school, but my God, they serve the most amazing breakfast. I've been there about 3 times now, and their coffee is very, very good for a coffee that's not... one of these new world coffees. It's good old. I think it's Illy they serve. It's great.
Ah, the old fashioned style.
The old fashioned style. Now, we speaking of old fashioned and styles, we need to talk about a style of sparkling wine that is fast becoming my very own favourite. And just this week, author and wine judge Nick Stock, who should be on the program in the next couple of weeks if we can drag him in, has bestowed Delzotto wines from the King Valley, Victoria, the award for the best value sparkling wine at the inaugural 2011 Good Wine Guide. Excuse me, awards at Adelaide's National Wine Centre that were held on Monday night. The drop that impressed the judges was the Delzotto Puccino Prosecco for its outstanding value at just $18.50 in for a case of that, please, and its approachable taste. So I thought we should speak to one of the, what seems to be many Delzottos. We've got Michael on the phone. Good afternoon, Michael. Welcome to Cravings.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, mate. Now, you're the winemaker at Delzotto?
Yeah, I'm the winemaker. I get to make sure everything tastes okay and especially the Prosecco.
What does Christian do then?
Christian's marketing.
Right.
Marketing, and today he's fronting up our little trattoria that we have there at Salvador that's open on weekends.
Nice.
Yeah, so he's out there, out and about.
Is it revolting up there weather-wise?
It's overcast, yeah. We're hoping for not too much rain, put it that way.
It's been bucketing down here, mate, so I hope you don't get too much.
No,
it's not the right time of the year, is it?
No, not really. But hopefully we'll get through all this, and then Primavera del Prosecco next weekend will be huge, I hope, with beautiful weather.
Well, of course, the La Dolce Vita Festival next weekend in and around the northeast. So you'll have the cellar door open, I understand.
Yeah, we'll have the cellar door. We're doing a dinner on Friday night, which we've booked out with Oscar W's and our staff from the Trattoria, and then. For Saturday, we've got music playing basically from about 12 till 8 p.m. where we finish the evening with a DJ and cocktails. So
Italian music?
I'm not too sure because I'm not in charge of the music side of things.
They'll leave you to the Prosecco. So let's talk a bit about Prosecco. It's Italy's version of a champagne. Is that a fair thing to say?
No, it's not.
There you go. I knew I'd get pulled up.
Sorry about that. What it is there's an area called Franciacorta in Italy, and that's Italy's version of champagne.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecco is a variety and also known as a style itself. So Prosecco, as opposed to, say, champagne or French sparkling wine, is more focused on secondary ferment characters, and you have more sort of yeast contact, that sort of thing, and the secondary ferment's done in bottle, whereas Prosecco, the secondary ferment's done in a pressurised tank, and it's more about preserving those primary fruit characters. So stuff like on the nose, you get this lovely hints of light jasmine and wisteria, and then on the palate, you get lovely, really like really crisp Granny Smith apple and lovely lemon zest. So really, really fresh and approachable.
Claire Winterburn is here with me. Say hello.
Hello.
Hello, Claire.
We are both sitting here, both holding our necks, clutching at our pearls, thinking we are both ready for a glass of Prosecco this very minute.
Well, that's the beauty about Prosecco. It's pretty much you can drink it any time of the day. It's just that style of drink. A style of drink, I think, that's just growing in popularity all the time.
Right. So the region is from Valdobbiadene in northeast Italy.
Valdobbiadene.
I did my best, Michael.
Seriously, you've done a pretty good job.
For a little white Irish boy from Redcliffs. So that's the home of the variety, and that's obviously where Dad Otto is from.
Yeah, Dad's originated from Valdobbiadene there in the north, which is about an hour north of Venice. And sort of stuck up there in the pre-Alps. So it's about, ranges from about 250 to 550 metres above sea level where they grow. And it was a dream of his to bring that variety and do it here in Australia, basically.
And he's passed that on to both yourself and, how many more of you are there?
There's myself and my three brothers, Simon, Julian and Christian.
Right. So you make the wine, Christian markets it. What do the other two do?
The other two come in on as often as possible and just drink.
I like the way they think. I really do.
If only I had brothers.
And then we pull them in for festival weekends and sort of make them pay their dues. So
nice one. Hey, tell me, silly question. How would Prosecco go with sardines?
Depends. It depends what they'd be really dressed with. If they were just dressed with lightly drizzled with oil.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be too bad because there's sort of that freshness of the Prosecco. And, I've not had a lot of sardines. Are they a subtle flavour or are they...
No. They're a smacker in the chops. Just that we have a tweet about someone's doing a trial with Vermentino, the Ducks in a Row Vermentino and sardines, with lemon, garlic, oregano, parsley, basil, olive oil, marinated overnight, thrown on the barbecue and served with some Vermentino.
Yeah, that's probably a better match, but because of the lemon in there, you probably could get away with it.
Yep.
So if not sardines, then what?
Generally with those just lighter style antipastos, like in Italy, they'll have it with some soups or some white bean soups. They'll have it with, if they're sitting around, with a bit of melon and prosciutto and just some of those more subtle canapes.
And what about a Bellini? Would it work for a Bellini, do you think?
Yeah, Bellini Prosecco is the quintessential ingredient of Bellini.
It's some beautiful, nice white peaches just picked off the tree.
Exactly.
With the Prosecco, I don't think it can go wrong.
No,
we'll be mixing them up this weekend, actually.
Yeah, well, nice, you're seeing the first of the peaches now, I see, in the market. Mm. So, yeah.
I've seen some little cricket ball nectarines.
Yes.
Not really. Yeah. Hey, Michael, if people want to call in and visit next weekend, because we're hoping the weather's going to improve over this week and we might actually see something that could resemble spring or summer, where will they find Del Zotto?
Drive into the heart of Whitfield, basically. Turn left.
Mm-hmm.
If you're coming from Mansfield.
Yep.
Go into the left and go towards Wangaratta, and you're about 500 metres up the road on the right-hand side, or if you're coming from Wangaratta, we're just at the 60 kilometre sign as you, 60 kilometre an hour as you drive into Whitfield. So basically right in the Whitfield, you'll see the signs, you'll see a jumping castle there, you'll see all sorts of stuff.
Oh, look, if you've got a jumping castle, I'm coming. That's it.
People people will be there playing bocce, having a great time, drinking cocktails and nice. Enjoying the great food.
Right, I'm jealous. I'll be getting on my skateboard and making my way up there. Can people find you on the interwebby thing?
Yes, they can. They can find us on the web, or they can contact the winery on 0357 298 321.
Lovely. Michael, thank you so much. Enjoy your afternoon.
No worries. Thank you for your
time. Cheers. Thank you. That's Michael Delzotto, one of... it seems a cast of Delzottos up there in northeastern Victoria. Have you been up to that part of the world, Claire?
I have, but not for a while. Yeah. Might be time to go back.
Yeah, I think if they've got a jumping castle, how can you say no?
And there's something about just the whole idea of La Dolce Vita.
Yes.
It's kind of a bit seductive.
The sweet life.
Indeed.
That's the literal translation. We're almost out of time.
Time flies when you're having fun, Pat.
Yeah, I know. Was there anything else we had to talk about before we go? Apart from people reading... Oh, what? Tell us about your blog. How can we...
The blog is... It's my neglected child. Family services will be on to me.
Yes, I have one as well.
Yes. I mean, the blog is a bit neglected at the moment, but it's something that I'm looking to kind of reinvigorate. Mm. So perhaps in the new year, that might be one to look out for. But in the meantime, please read my column.
Yes, read the column.
Let me know what you think.
Tell them how good it is.
Yeah. And one of my upcoming topics is going to be the vexed issue of... bloggers, food bloggers as food critics. So I'm interested if you've got any thoughts. You know, do you use Urban Spoon? Do you use blogs as a guide for where you eat out? What do you think about people making anonymous criticism of restaurants? Is it more honest or is it just a license to hate? Send me an email. Let me know what you think.
I have some thoughts on that.
Excellent.
I know quite a few bloggers who carry some influence, both in Melbourne and in Sydney. Who are associated with the industry in one way or another and always have been. But it's an interesting question you raise about the objectivity of a blog. And I have to say that I have jumped onto Urban Spoon.
I use it.
I've used it. I tend to trust more the valued opinion of my friends. If somebody says to me, because they know what I'm like, they know that I'm a fussy shit. If somebody says to me, I went and ate at such and such the other night and I thought it was fantastic, then I have to go.
I think that's definitely a good measure. And what I like about the internet is that I think that people get a different experience. Like your everyday punter or food blogger probably gets a more real experience than a food critic at a restaurant. So, you know, I think there are pros and cons with both.
Very quickly, there's a new TV show I found. Have you heard it? I think it's Michael Winning, who is a very severe, old, crotchety British food critic.
Oh, he sounds like my kind of guy.
Oh, he's hilarious. I've just discovered this new show and I thought, I really don't like this man. I think he's a pompous old shit. And then I discovered at the end of the show he was crying, saying he's never had an experience with more heart and more warmth. And there was me having a little teary. One quick text message before we go. Mark says, hi, folks. I grew up in the King Valley with the Delzottos. Good people, great wine, perfect area for a break. I think that's a lovely way to sum up the show. Claire, thank you so much for giving me your time and coming and spending
an
hour.
Thank you for having me, Pete.
Must have you back.
Please.
We'll have a bit of a MasterChef reunion. We'll have yourself and Poe and Callum and Adam and Courtney and...
You're not going to get a word in.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
That's probably a good thing. I'll make sure I've got a sore throat when that happens.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.